residual, not toxic, but it's constructive. It's a sanitizing, and it cleans the body for the first time, living in a state of purity. And therefore, that reason they say the saint is drunk in God and walks around, talks just like a drunk man. Only one difference between him and the actual alcoholic is that his body doesn't have any residue nor any breakdown from the alcoholic effect of his own biological process. Whereas the other person who drank a filtered substance from a grape or any object would have a residue. Yeah.
I'm afraid I have a residue because I got a headache. So what went wrong there?
No, the headache is basically what Yogananda called the maddening band. Mm-hmm. When you meditate and you there is a band around your head, and you open your eyes, you feel like there's something sitting there, right? Like a mm-hmm. invisible cap on your head. That's what they call the maddening band. It's because your brain slowed down to delta level, but you not knowing what delta level is and having no way to remind you that you went to the delta level, this sensation of a band that is permeating around the endorphin system is reminding you that you are in an analgesic state, not an anesthetic state, an analgesic state that you can withstand any amount of frustration now without panic, but because it feels like a heavy sensation, you call it a headache.
I get it around Mama too. He just walks in the room, you feel like
well, it's not. No, what you're feeling is the body of the realized person that is capable of going to delta level over and over by the meditation is setting up the unified field, because the delta level is the unified field. So if they function at that level, and that's what darshan is, anybody who is outside of the delta level is going to be pulled into it by automatic magnetism and get a suspension of the beta, the theta, and the alpha. And then they'll stay in that delta and they'll just drift in it till they have to come back to function. But they have to have something to remind them that they were there. And it's this funny sensation of the head that Yogananda used to call the maddening band. It's maddening because no aspirin is going to get rid of it. But it's a fact that it does exist as a reminder that you're in the delta. I walk around with it like somebody put a crown of thorns on my head, is there. And so that's, but then when you start working with it in the waking state, that's what you want it. You're not when you're in the meditative state. You want to be able to work with it so that it directs you to be observant. Then that sensation is no longer a trip. It's just like an invisible hat on your head. So some people see it as a light. And then they call it a halo. But really, it's your own electrical field that is ignited up by the meditative process to resonate around the delta frequency of the brain.
Is it the same thing as like a sledgehammer effect on the top of the head?
Yeah. So you can feel it all. I mean, when you're in tune with it, you hear the sound currents more and more.
What can you do when you have it most of the time?
When you have it most of the time, when you're working, just relax and enjoy it. And when you're not working, just sit down and enjoy it. And you'll notice the more you enjoy it, you have no desire to sleep. And the more you enjoy it, you have no desire to feel tired. Now, again, and the more you enjoy it, you have no desire to eat. And the more you enjoy it, very few people come to bother you. And the more you enjoy it, people with their problems start to get well without even telling them. So this is what they call the unified field. Now you know it. You and the Christ principle are one. I and the Father are one. That function is your oneness. So it's sitting down and learning to feel it, learning to identify with it, and function. And don't be afraid to get up and do your work, because it will always fluctuate to give you enough competency not to be irrational to function. and it will guide you in your activity. It's a sonic wave too, around you. You can hear like a buzzing sound all around your ears. And your right side is the right thing to do. Your left side is the wrong thing to do. So if you have decisions to make, and you're asking yourself, what should I do? You can actually feel which side of the head gets heavy, tight, or loose. Which ears get more buzzing or not. All the right side is the right thing to do. All the left side is the wrong thing to do. So you are guided from inside by your own intrinsic principle of the right magnetic movement, like a radar. So realized men don't have anything more than to do that. Let go, let God guide them. So they come out smelling like a rose. We come out smelling buttered up. See? So it's because we don't listen to the cellular structure. We don't feel. But when we start doing it, more and more we become intuitive or clairvoyant. We start to respond. And that's the prophetic qualities that are all labeled. But it's learning to listen and feel. And you begin to recognize it.
In the Bible, I don't know, it's always bothered me that churchianity teaches that Jesus on the cross said, Father, why hast thou forsaken me? That just was so inconsistent.
I would suggest that you read the 22nd Psalm. He was repeating the 22nd Psalm to himself. In the 22nd Psalm, that statement is there. Has nothing to do with God forsaking him. The realized man is repeating certain laws under certain. If you're experiencing pain, what would be the most ideal way to go through it? Complaining or diverting your mind from it so that the endorphins will take over and help you pass through. If you complain, the pain gets stronger because you're identifying with the pain, right? If you're repeating something over and over, the brain switches away from the sensation of pain, and one can say he's hypnotizing his own self by repeating words. I don't feel no pain, I don't feel... Whatever you say to yourself in a repetitive manner helps the brain to shift from identification with the painful sensation to a non-painful sensation. And therefore he was repeating the 23rd Psalm to himself on the cross. And if you read it, you'll see that statement, Father, have been forgiven me. Now, most people make all kind of connotations, but the 23rd Psalm was written before Jesus was ever crucified. It's written by Solomon. And it has nothing to do with being forsaken by God, in the sense it was he who read it. But if you go back and look at it, whoever, you have a book on it, the 23rd Psalm, again. In the meantime, let's take a break, and he's getting it.
Okay.
It's number 22.
Or 22 or 23?
No, 22.
22.
Oh,
it's Psalm 22, not 20.
Okay.
He's repeating the 22nd Psalm. And as I said, the Psalm was written before he ever lived.
I'm having trouble with my vocals. Bob, you want to read it?
Okay.
Remember,
going to start.
Yoo-hoo, in the kitchen.
We're reading from the Holy Scriptures, the whole Scriptures.
This is the passion and triumph of the Messiah, the 22nd Psalm, for the leader according to the Hind of the Dawn, a Psalm of David. My God, why have you forsaken me? Far from my prayer, from the words of my cry, O my God, cry out by day, and you answer not, by night, and there is no relief for me. Yet you have enthroned in the, you are enthroned in this holy place, O God of Israel. In you our fathers trusted. They trusted, and you delivered them. To you they cried, and they escaped. In you they trusted, and they were not put to shame. But I am a worm, not a man, the scorn of man, despised by the people. All who see me scoff at me. They mock me with parted lips. They wag their heads. He relied on the Lord. They let him deliver him. Let him rescue him if he loves him. You have been my guide since I was first informed, my security at my mother's breast. To you I was committed at birth. From my mother's womb you are my God. And not far from me, for I am in distress. Be near, I have no one to help me. Many bullocks surround me. The strong bulls of Bashan encircle me. They open their mouths against me like raven and roaring lions. I am like water poured out. All my bones are racked. My heart has become like wax, melted away within my bosom. My throat is dried up like baked clay. My tongue cleaves to my jaws. To the dust of death you have brought me down. Indeed, many dogs surround me. A pack of evildoers close in upon me. They have pierced my hands and my feet, and I can count all my bones. They look on and gloat over me. They divide my garments among them. And they, my vesture, they cast lots. But you, O Lord, are not far from me. O help, O my help, hasten to aid me. Rescue my soul from the sword, my loneliness from the grip of the dog. Save me from the lion's mouth, from the horns of the wretched wild bulls, my wretched life. I proclaim your name to my brethren. To the midst of the assembly I will praise you. You who fear Lord, praise him. All your descendants of Jacob, give glory to him. Rever him, all you descendants of Israel. For he has not spurned or disdained the wretched man in his misery, nor has he turned his face away from him. But when he cried out to him, he heard him. So by your gift will I utter praise in the vast assembly. I will fulfill my vows before those who fear him. The lowly shall eat their fill. They will seek the Lord who praise him. May your hearts be ever merry. All the end of the earth shall remember and turn to the Lord. All the families of the nations will bow down before him. The dominion is the Lord's, and he will rule the nations. To him alone shall bow down all who sleep in the earth. Before him shall bend all who goes down unto dust. To him my soul shall live. My descendants shall serve him. Let the coming generation be told of the Lord. And they will proclaim to the people yet to be born the justice he has shown.
Now, you see, he described
just what was happening.
But that was written before it happened to him by David. You see? So most people never knew it, that he was actually reciting a documentation of a perceived information written long before. But the very first few lines is what they heard. They never heard the rest of what he was saying to himself, because he was repeating it to himself. But what they heard is, my God, why don't you say it? And right away they jumped to the conclusion he's calling out for God. But in actuality, he's repeating the process of the projection of the knowledge that has been picked up by David, what he has to live out. And every description is there in it. So it's not God is forsaking him, or is he crying out in anguish. He is actually intoning knowledge to divert the mind from the painful sensation of the nails by reactivating information pertaining to it.
Like a mantra, too.
Yeah, that's right. So he knew what he was doing. He wasn't just living it out on the cross with agony of frustration and rejection. But he's already living out a projected observation that had to happen. And if he didn't go through it, someone else would have to go through it. But he came to go through it, so it was his own role.
Thank you.
Any more?
I wonder if you could talk about why Christ has risen as a symbol of God more so than other, quote, enlightened beings. Like, he's known everywhere, you know, because of somehow...
Well, it was the first time among the Jewish people. Remember, he came to his own, and his own received him not. That was the real issue of why it has come through the ages. Western men get their religious origin from the transition period of the Hebrew people under restraint by the Roman government. Now, countries to the far east were having their liberators, but it was not involving the Western movement of men. The Roman Empire stopped just outside of Egypt and Palestine in those areas, and therefore it was within the Roman Empire that the period of Jesus came to experience. So he was born among Jews to lift up Jews, but it's the Jews who didn't accept him, because why? He was not offering them a type of liberation they wanted. What they really wanted was somebody who would come and drive the Romans out. He came to teach them how to cope with the Romans by living in the moment. They didn't like that. So when they were the Romans were going to offer them a chance to select some leader, and they gave them either Jesus or Barabbas. Barabbas was classified as a thief, not in the sense that we know thieves to be. The normal thief is one who breaks in your house and take your documentation or possessions and go off and try to be rich off of it. Barabbas was not that kind of thief. Barabbas, what you call a guerrilla, one who was fighting the Roman from the underground method to constantly get them out of his country. So he was that type of a thief. He was raiding the Roman trains and all their cannon trains to get weapons to carry on a constant battle from the Herod time against them. So he was more of the people's hero. He had a mission to live for. Jesus didn't come with that. Jesus came as a man who was going to free them from their emotional hang-ups. He couldn't chase away Caesar's government. He didn't come here to bring more war to save the people. He came to teach them how to cope by turning the cheek. Now, if he didn't do it, the Romans themselves would not be the first one to turn towards him. It's because he did it. When his own people couldn't accept him as a champion for their cause, and then he offered his method to all those who would accept him or believe in his name. So last Sunday, which you call Palm Sunday, when he rode into the city on a donkey, all the people were underprivileged, burdened down by their own people, the rich, and by the government of Rome, they flocked to him, greeting him. But he went through a process of a betrayal by his own loved one, and it was planned that he had to do it, simply because he was confused. What kind of teacher or what kind of leader am I going to follow? Am I going to follow one who's going to drive out these Romans and make me a head of the executive council? That was Judas way of thinking. He didn't think of it as being some kind of a council someplace in a realm of emotion. He was thinking in the realm of, hey man, drive these Romans out, we have a government, we're going to be on top. Back to where we were in the days of Solomon and David and all those guys. But he had no such thing to offer them. He had only one thing to offer them: how to cope with the moment. That was hard for the Jewish heritage, and I've worked with a lot of Jewish rabbi friends. They all say, it's impossible for us to grasp, accept that. It's not our heritage. It came out of us, but we can't cope with it. It destroys everything we fought for or lived for. So they say, which is better, cut off my nose and spoil my face, or push my head in the dirt and hide? So I says, I agree with you, I can't hate you for rejecting him. He says, I'd rather push my head in the dirt and not admit I know him than cut off my nose and walk around and say, I love him. And so I respect the Jewish man for that. And so he actually lived to teach a different type of liberation from tyranny, not the type that Barabbas was trying to initiate. So when the Roman governor, Pilate, in order to keep peace among the people, since he was the supervisor of the time, offered a chance for the people to accept somebody to be at their amnesty, they chose Barabbas. Then Pilate is stuck with Jesus. What do I do with this other man? He knows the man ain't done a single thing to work the Roman Empire to do anything to him. So he's put the thing right back on the Jewish people. He said, what do you want with this guy? I can't kill him. I don't have the right to kill him. He didn't do nothing to hurt the Roman government. Yeah, I would rather get rid of that guy Barabbas for breaking up our trains and quicker than this guy. But the very people shouted, crucify him, because that's the only way the Roman government would treat any kind of a political prisoner, to make them an example to the country they were regulating, so that they wouldn't rebel. Crucifixion was the method. And that started in the time of Spartacus. There was no crucifixion by the Roman government for anybody. Spartacus was the first man to rebel against the Roman government, and when he was captured by the early Caesars, they made an example that nobody will ever rebel against Rome again. So they strung him up along the Appian Way and tied him. They didn't actually nail him because nobody was nailing you. They wanted him to die a slow death to put the fear in people who will rebel against the Roman. That was the only way they know their laws. It seems crude, yes, but that's what they have to live through at the time. So when they say crucify him, they crucified him. But fear is a different thing. The normal crucifixion for criminal is to tie you and break your bones and let you suffer in pain and anguish for approximately 4 to 6 days before you actually die off. So that is just not a very fast death. In his case, he is the first on record to be nailed. And he's quoting how he's going to die already, from a documentation of a realized person who lived and wrote it. David was enlightened at the time when he slew Goliath, and due his deep moments of fasting before he touched the ark again to bring rain in his country, then they accused him for cohorting with Bathsheba. And that's how those Psalms were written. He was a man who was blamed for a lot of things, but he wrote these things from a deep intuitive nature, predicting the life of the man Jesus. And the man Jesus came after and read these things, because these documents were all in the heritage of the church, of the Jewish faith, the synagogue. So he's repeating that knowledge. But he lived through to show that he was not going to fight it. But he's nailed for the first time to the cross. Now, normally, if you study anatomy, it's not possible to nail a person through here. You'll break the bone. And you can't nail them here, you'll break the bone. So therefore, the incorrect drawings of the actual crucifixion create a problem in the churches. The actual nailing is in between here, where there's an opening. Now, we know nails to be wrong, thinking that's all the way nails were always made. Nails aren't made wrong way back in his time, because they didn't have the equipment to make a wrong nail. All they knew was to take ore out of the ground, heat it up, and beat the heck out of it for the size they need to work with. And why would they use a nail? Where would they use nails? Most of the buildings in those days were like the mission, the Dobie rock kind of finish. Nail was only used in the tying of wood to form a boat at the bow. They pin them there. And if you find any, you're finding these nails today now, as deep sea divers are finding them, they're broken away from boats that have crashed in over the centuries in the underwater, and they flush them. Some of them are washed up even on the coast of San Francisco, because not too long ago somebody showed me one that was washed up. And it's shaped like a chisel. this long with a head, and it's squarish and flat, pointed like a square bar, flattened up like somebody beat the end off to make it like a chisel. So you can imagine that's the type of nail they had in those days that would fit in here. It's small like this, the thickness of my finger, and it'll go here between the bone, but it's flattened out to the edge where it can pass through. So it's just like old-fashioned, you see chisels like that. And that's the kind of nail they used to use. So they nailed him, and no bone was broken. That was evidence that for the first time they're doing something that was not the tradition. He is being used as an example by the people who don't want it. Now, the people who are crying for him are not only Jews, they're Greeks, they're all nationalities there, except the Romans. The Romans are the ones who are standing guard. But then, the centurion, the fellow who actually is in charge of the execution, knows that this is goes against the grain. Why are you killing an innocent man is being killed? Regardless, he's an enemy, the government, he's going to feel something that this goes against the grain. He can't constantly feel, you know what I mean? It don't make sense. You don't kill an innocent man. Your worst enemy, what did he really do? Feel me? So he is in a bind. So he withdraws from the scene. And they are still locked into the custom that they got to have the Sabbath. Imagine the people that are following him have to have the Sabbath. They're torn between their own heritage and they're torn with accepting a new system of living. And in the meantime, the gorilla fellow is out there having a ball trying to round up a ruckus. So, now, a rich man by the name of Arimathea, and Jesus had many sponsors. And those who were fishermen that were renunciate lived with him and worked with him. But like in everything else today, the biggest ashrams are sponsored by who? The people who have the money to provide these. So home of the rich man, Lazarus, Arimathea, and all these men, Jesus would be like, I'm talking, you come as a visitor, and spend the time and talk to people, and go his way. And so Arimathea was one such man, Joseph of Arimathea, and he realized that he couldn't work on a Saturday. It's against his tradition, even though he's an initiate, or what they call a household initiate, he's going to conform. So he go and ask for the body. Because, why? They said, Jesus gave up the ghost. Father, into thy hands I commend my spirit. If he was really complaining to God, why have you forsaken me? Why would he say, I commend my spirit? You see? So we know he wasn't complaining. He was doing something, but it's to track it down what that something was. It's until you look through all the documents and then you come across his whole description of his life in the 22nd Psalm. Then you see the whole thing is the man is repeating something to himself, a reminder. All right. Joseph goes to get this permission to take the body down and wraps it up in some herbs and puts it away in the coffin. That's yesterday afternoon before the sun goes down. Now, you remember yesterday around 3 o'clock what was happening in this little town here? Mm. The wind was blowing like crazy. That's the exact time in centuries ago when he gave up the ghost. The evidence that an innocent man is being killed for ignorance and the vengeance between individuals. So life has to have some way to remind us that what we are doing and what we believe in can be not always what it is. So there we had a tremendous indication of something going on to remind us. Today, which is the day after, the body is taken down and put in the coffin and put in the sealed up so that. But prior to that, when Joseph went and asked for the body, it is the authority of the centurion in charge to make sure that the body is dead. And he could not being a military man involved with military arts, would accept that a person is dead that fast by being nailed. It don't make sense, because you would know from his military training how quick does a person die, and if he's any person in authority, he had applied torture in his life. So you would know that it asking for a dead body, the person is dead, didn't make sense. So you would have to go send somebody to make sure that the guy wasn't faking. So what he sent was what we would call a sapper. A sapper is a type of a man in those days that walked behind the military men wherever they went. And when the armies defeated the enemy, it was custom that the enemy would fake dead and lie down among the dead bodies. And when the armies were marching across, they would suddenly get up and stab them in the back. So the Roman army made sure that no such thing would happen to them after it had occurred with fighting with different nations, that they play that kind of trickery. So behind every legion, which is 100, which marched with their centurion, every centurion had 100 men. So his group, there were so many sappers, that the guys who walked behind the apparent dead soldier and poke him with a spear to make sure he was dead and not faking dead. So this is exactly why the centurion sent the soldier to check. If Jesus is really dead, you're going to find out. You say he's dead? Good. Let's find out, and then you have the body, it's yours. We did our job. We're not so, we're absolved from any future blame that we didn't give you somebody who is not dead. In case they come back to Caesar or Pilate and say, look, your man delivered a living man, and he escaped. No way to prove that. So what they did, he sent this soldier, and the soldier stuck in the left side of where the heart is, and they said it broke the heart also, that blood and water came out. Medical doctors know today that a dead man does not give off water if he's in a state of what is known as terminal death. But if he's in the state of what we call clinical death, the body will give off water if you cut the skin. Blood and water will come out. So Jesus was in what is known as a clinical death, not a terminal death. There's two different biological states. Terminal death is the level of decomposition. Clinical death is in the level of non-decomposition, and all functions that are pertaining to sensory functions of seeing, hearing, breathing, and so forth are all clinically turned down, but not turned off. One can say the body was in a deep state of suspended animation, but it will not respond to any physical administration to wake it up. Yet it's not in a coma. That's another state, you see. So he was really in a clinical death state, giving up the ghost. Now, Father, into thy hands I commend my spirit. The body went down into what we would call clinical death, or omega, just slightly below delta. They took the body down, they put it in the coffin, and then they seal it up, and they're satisfied. Now, how is the Roman soldier going to be satisfied if Jesus is really dead? He doesn't know the difference between blood and water, because he's not a technician doctor. He's just somebody who pokes into a mechanism, and his guidelines of being living or dead is, well, if you do that, he finishes you. You know you ain't dead, right? Because the sudden surprise of being poked with a sharp object, you let out a yell. He'll finish the person, but then there was no sound. Then that's the assumption on the Roman soldier that the person is dead. He's not going to go and question and say, I saw blood and water coming to the bone of my spear. He has not that training. He's concerned with only one reaction. Since the sound came out, he reported to the centurion the body. The centurion granted the body to be taken down and put away. Then, later on, comes the condition. If that is all there was to happen for the sake of being recorded, yesterday would be the end of the knowledge relating to Jesus. He was put away, and you can go visit the body there in Bethlehem, and that's it. But something happened to wake up the world for the first time, not only his own people, not only the people that accepted him for what he was, what I think he is, but those who respected him from the distance of being destroyed by his own people without any reason. He had admirers for the first time. It doesn't matter how much a man is militaristically powerful and respects might and would have exercised his might to keep his possession, he respects another quality in another human being, integrity. That's the one thing that a strong man. A strong man is strong, but he also respects honesty and integrity. That's what keeps him strong. Mm-hmm. He will do everything in his power to stay on top by being strong, but he will always respect another person who is honest and have the integrity because he knows that's even stronger than the soul. See? And that's where the Roman soldiers and the Roman men that were Pilate and all these men began to respect Jesus the man, not the people. He had something that reflected their integrity. They're in position of power. They're in position of taking life. But then they're in the position to grant amnesty or compassion. Once you're put in those positions to act, the only thing that will shake you up is an honest man. Because you're right. Mm-hmm. The one who isn't threatening you, your own integrity is threatening you now. Mm-hmm. Because you may have excuses for your integrity. He doesn't have excuses for his integrity. He is, that's it. So they respect that. So from that standpoint, he had admirers apart from the people who he came to help. That comes now as a, let's say, tremendous appreciation. Now, the people then, losing their leader, where would they go? They're still under the rule of the Roman government. They can't leave Judea and go to another country. There's no country to go to that would accept them. And so they are there, and then they're going to be persecuted. Why? Who's going to really persecute them? The ones that are in power or the ones who don't want them to have a chance to develop? Because it will take away from their importance. So the people who were financially in a position to feel threatened by the upsurge of this conversion began to feel threatened. So they began to make sure that these people will never have a chance to take over their position. So they made all kind of bizarre games with them to the point where they became like a bounty hunter, rounding them up to be persecuted or prosecuted by the Roman government. Now, Paul was one such man. Before he was called Saul, he was an actual bounty hunter who made his money by hunting down the converted Christian, turned him over to the Roman government for a fee. So that went on for quite a while. But remember, this is occurring in a Roman-occupied country. It's not occurring outside of it. So when the issue between honesty, integrity, and the right to live, and the destruction of violence by every method of punishment is coming to a standstill. It's what you say, violence versus nonviolence. If you say Mahatma Gandhi started nonviolence, no. The very first people who believe that they'd rather die for a conviction than offer violence began way back in those days. But it moved westward because Rome is located west. Jerusalem is in the Middle East, right? And so they're going to take back to Rome some fella who is challenging the might of Rome, not by the sword now, but the might of the mouth. Who are they carrying back? A guy by the name of Paul. You understand? So this is the argument. Now, they weren't taking him to China. They weren't taking him to Persia. They're taking him to Rome. So the people in Rome now are going to pride themselves with what? Power and intellect, because they are the rulers. They got to hear a kind of logic that you're going to kill yourself without fighting, that is going to match their logic, that they will back up with fighting. See? So when they come to confront each other, the Roman government sees right away that these people are pushing an issue of logic without violence. All right. The Roman Colosseum is not located where? In Jerusalem. It's located in Rome. What are they throwing in those Colosseums? Innocent people to be what? Eaten by animals if you don't want to listen to the power of Rome. That's the early martyrs. They walk in because they don't believe in fighting. They want their freedom and they want their right to live their life. Rome don't want to give up those countries for what? It's income for them without having to fight. It's an avenue where they can get grain and all these different things going back to Rome. So this is challenging Rome's very integrity to keep these people. So they throw them into the arena to be destroyed. But then what happens? Again, the strong man is touched by the valor of the honest man. And that's what weakens the strong man. His might is no power no more. He can't cope with that. It's a terrible mental anguish. You can be very strong with a sword, and if the person right next to you doesn't use any violence, just his honesty is enough to make him suffer the most. It tears it. And that's what happened to the best of Rome. That's how the great converts began. They weren't among the poor. It's among the very wealthy that the conversion began. The very intellectual couldn't stand it. They are the ones who began to say, no, this, I'm a man like, Constantine. He was thrown into the arena to defend a Christian believer and refused to use a weapon to defend himself against the gladiator. He just used the actual staff. And when he beat the gladiator, the normal penalty is when you beat your enemy is to what?
Kill
him. Mm-hmm. So they call on Caesar to give the sign of execution. And Constantine refused to kill the man. And Caesar kept doing like this. No. Then some soldier behind saw that this was not fair even for Caesar to do a thing like that. When the man defended himself against all odds and came out a winner, not even wanted to hurt him, this soldier then took the spear and killed Caesar. And that was the first real breakthrough for Constantine. They wanted Constantine to be now the new ruler, because they felt, and when Constantine became the ruler, the first thing he did, no more punishment for these people in the arena. And it was his first contribution and change that the West, because most of Rome, the Empire of Rome, extended right up to a place called Britain. See how far it came. So for that reason, Christianity had its avenues open for spreading westward more than eastward as a start. And so we end up now moving westward again from Spain, Italy, Britain, to what they call Americas. Therefore, we find that this part of the world, the knowledge of that life came more than it went eastward. So, but then the missionaries went around and started traveling, they found that there were other great men who were already working in the different areas of that knowledge. But again, the knowledge is not spread in the other countries by the kings and the queens. Whereas in this country, the kings and the queens were integrated with the church. When you go back to all the early kings of the Western Hemisphere, they were all crowned by the church. Mm-hmm. And the church was Christian. So for that reason, we are the heirs of a Christian program, more so than the people who were kings and queens in the other area. The king and the queen in the other area may serve the country, and when they feel they've had enough of it, they will take the vow of renunciation and go follow Buddha or some other person up in the mountains. And that's how they went off. The king in this country don't do that. He's crowned a Christian, and like it or not, he's going to be a Christian, even if he's a lousy one. But he's crowned that way, you see. Over the other way, he's nothing. He's just the king or the queen. And when he decides he had enough of that life, and he wants to take the vow of renunciation, then he goes for a spiritual life.
And if Christ was created to...
gets up in the morning and walks the room in a square, and I did it to them. And this is what they repeat in English. In Hebrew, they repeat it. But when translated in English, it goes like, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord thy God is one. Hear, O Israel, the Lord thy God is one." And they walk around their room as a square, going around. And that square is their wailing wall. They cry and make all genuflections to God inside. Now they don't have any more than that from the home to the synagogue, where the rabbi reads the scrolls pertaining to the laws left to them by Moses, Ten Commandments, and how the journey through the desert and their sufferings with the different nations is their constant reminder not to forsake their origin. Now, they are looking for a Messiah. Mm-hmm. Not in the sense that Jesus came to liberate them from their fixations about life, but someone who would give them back their country and set them up as the chosen race of the world. That's their version of Messiah. I don't blame them for that. They are programmed for that. Why? Because they began as people trapped by their own ignorance when they couldn't grow food. Hundreds and hundreds of years ago. And they ended up outside a country called Egypt. They couldn't afford to buy enough corn to go back home, but just enough to eat right there. That forced them to become workers. And if you have to depend on somebody providing work, he holds the cost factor of your ability to perform. So he may tell you, "I want a day's work for a penny." You may say, "Yes, because I got to eat one grain of corn." And that was the bargaining power. That's how come Moses came into existence. These people were trapped all around there from all different parts of the world. They came there and they got trapped. They couldn't go back home to buy. Well, Egypt would be like America in those days, having the only corn to sell to the world. And you imagine all along the Atlantic coast and the Pacific coast here, everybody's camped out between Canada and Mexico, just buying enough and can't go back home to the other parts of the world. And the corn is only right there. And that's what happened in Egypt then. So they eventually ended up being underpaid workers, or classified as slaves, unpaid. Moses came. But the Egyptians had already passed birth control laws. We know it today as birth control laws. In those days, firstborn of every other nation ain't gonna, especially male, ain't gonna have a chance to survive, because they're the ones who multiply the people and make it more and more population. So that was their birth control method. All male children would not be allowed to survive. Only the female children, and then the Egyptians would take them as wives, and that would make the Egyptian race bigger and bigger. But it was a crude form of birth control passed by the Egyptian laws in those days to maintain the people in a minimal reproduction level. Moses was born a male, his parents tried to save his life, and did what they said, slid him down the river. And the Pharaoh's sister saw the baby and saved it, and he was adopted into the family as an Egyptian prince. He grew up and studied the Egyptian knowledge. Then when he was fully accepted as one of the Egyptian princes, came the breaking point. He found out he was not truly an Egyptian, he was an adopted person. His true nature was Hebrew. Then he decided to withdraw. These people claim their heritage now. From that moment on, when Moses came down from the mountain bringing the documents of how they should live, and go tell the Pharaoh to let the people go. So when he went into where the Pharaoh was and he challenged the Pharaoh couldn't listen to him, because the Pharaoh grew up with him. They were, of the same family, the same father. One was a legitimate son and the other one was an adopted son. And he recognizes him and he says, well, I know him. So they play games by throwing on the rod and say, I turn to snake. They said, oh, I got, where do you think you learned your snake game from? So he calls them, they throw down their snake. But the sense of focus is the determining factor. In Moses' mind, he wasn't doing it to please outward demonstration. He was doing it for dedicated thought, to lift up life. His snake appeared to swallow the other snake, overriding their authority in the consciousness. This began to be a challenge for the Pharaoh, and all the things that he did, finally the Pharaoh had to let them go out. And then when the Red Sea closed in on the Pharaoh trying to chase after them, that was the end of the tyranny. But for 40 years, Moses wandered in the desert. Where would he go? Trying to find a home for his people. Now some explorers say he was a fool not to go to the left. He went to the right of the desert. And so they ask, why did he make the mistake and go right instead of to the left in the fork of the desert where he's supposed to have gone? And they look at his marks of the ancient scrolls. Lands to the west were barren, left. Lands to the left were barren. Lands to the right could become fertile. Now, starving masses, uneducated, with some craft, what would be the incentive? Land that is possible to raise food that is fertile, or to take a chance with a barren looking land that don't have any possibility? Common sense would say no. Yet all the lands to the right became fertile to provide food for the Jewish people. Yet the lands to the left that looked barren today contains all the oil of the world. And therefore the struggle is, they thought they got gypped. You see, Moses led them down a bad track. If that's today's version, if you get down and ask a Jewish guy, if you had a chance to choose back now, where would you choose? He said, sure, I'll choose the barren land. They got all the oil. I said, yeah, but who could eat it then? You see, how time changes. the land to the right was the land they came into, and they grew their food and started their country again. But they didn't have no kings. They only had Moses and the priest to give them the scrolls to start their life. And from that reason on, they start building something to represent their heritage, right up to the time of the Roman Empire. But between that, because they saw every country having a king, they wanted a king. And their first king was Saul. And then their second king was David, and their third king was Solomon. And then finally they started a phase of they had no more kings. They only had quislings, governors, because they were conquered. And they were fighting a last minute battle when Jesus came into their life. So today, if you go into the Jewish tradition, he isn't concerned with Jesus. That's not part of his belief system. He stops exactly at Herod. He stops at the fact that he is still looking for that Messiah that will liberate him from all the tyranny of the world and give him back his country. So when Zionism came in and the United States backed up the right of Israel to be a state, that is what they fought. That's their belief system. And they will not deviate from that because they feel that's their belief system. Now, when the man Jesus came along, he was trying to help them out of that fixation. And he passed away. And 400 years after came Muhammad. Now, Muhammad had to make restitution for something that the Jewish people failed to do. Abraham was a Chaldean who had two sons from two wives. One was a legal wife and the other one was not. His legal wife could not bear children. And therefore she said to Abraham, why don't you go with the maid and have a child, because you're an old man. You'd be over 100 by then. She was a 60, the wife. You have to have some heir to carry on. So the young maid was forced to be mother to Abraham's first son, Ishmael. Then she was taunted by the wife who tried to show off to the real wife, hey look, I'm able to carry a child, you can't carry. So the legitimate wife got angry and forced the husband to throw her out. She went to where she came from her heritage, with her people. She had no way to be compensated. Then the legitimate wife had a son for the first time. His name was Isaac. Then he had to live through the same agony of what his mother lived through and his father lived through. Because why? He got blind. He had two sons, one a big robust guy by the name of Esau, and one a very small, squeaky type of a kid called Jacob. But the two brothers were confronting each other one day, and the big, hefty brother says, hey, I'm hungry, give me something to eat. And the other says, well, what would you give me if I give you food to eat? Oh, I'll give you my birthright. Big deal. In those days, nice thing to talk about. But when the issue came, the boy claimed his birthright because the father has the power to give away the birthright to the eldest child. And so the mother, realizing her son didn't have the robustness like the first son, she would have to trick the father. So she wrapped the son's hands up with some woolen skin and carried the food and offered the father the food that he loved to eat. He was blind. And so he commented, your hands feel like Esau and your voice sound like Jacob, yet the food is the same food, you see. So anyway, he blessed the son and gave him all the inheritance, whatever, even though he's strict into it. And yet when the elder son comes back and presents what the father had, the father realized and the elder brother sought to kill the younger brother for the trickery. That kind of a condition has been in the Jewish mental makeup to this day, the betrayal and the denial. Now, Muhammad came to resolve that among the followers of Ishmael, who were the Middle Eastern, they were all Semitic groups. One only lived to the west of the land, and one lived to the east of the land. So he had to resolve that. So when he came to those people, his comment to them is, don't marry one woman and make another woman unwholesome. It's better to have two wives than to have one wife and an unwholesome woman. Just like what Abraham did, having one wife and one woman was unwholesome to the family. Marry them both if you can provide for them. If you want to marry 10, good, but provide for them. And that way everybody's equal in the house. And that got rid of the anguish among them. Then he gave them the writings of Allah is one, Muhammad is his prophet. Meaning now, from now on, God is always with you. Make restitution with your fellow. That came down. So in that knowledge, there have been saints that went through their own internal training. They call them the Sufis. They also developed the non-decomposing body technique. Many of them have had it, right up to Kabir. And Kabir lived about 1600. Now think of this, Kabir was a wealthy man's son who left his home and was sent by the father to go do merchandising to buy different things. And he didn't please the father because he gave away instead of buying anything. He was that kind of boy. He would take his stuff and give it away. So when he came to confront his father's belief system, he decided that he would rather serve society than adhere to his father's convictions. And what did he do? He decided to teach the Muslims and the Hindus to respect each other and not get involved with war, because the Arabic Empire had spread a long time right up into India. See, under that particular period of time, the spread of the Islam was all the way to India and the Middle East, almost right up to Europe. Kabir came along and was trying to resolve the conflict between the two groups, the Hindus and the Muslims. The day that Kabir decides to die, he's standing in front of them, giving his last sermon, and lies down there in the coffin. The Hindu decided that according to their tradition, you cremate the body. The Muslim, according to his tradition, we bury the body. Now, the two of them are arguing back and forth to cremate, to bury, cremate, to bury. Kabir gets up and looks at them, shakes his head, and disappears right in front of their eyes. But he leaves them two roses in the coffin. The Hindu took their rose and burnt it. The Muhammadan took their rose and buried it. And the coffin is still there, nobody claiming it. Do you see? So every nationality has had some liberated person, yet the fixations of the society still goes on. Jesus has come. Tomorrow will be a day of showing us of the wonders of the great power of the human being. Yet the fixations of the Jew is still today. He hasn't changed. He's not going to accept that, because he doesn't see that as his liberation. Just as much as the Islam and the Hindus don't see where these men is their liberation. One wants to bury the dead and one wants to cremate them. Then there's another person that came. His name is Nanak. He came, and he tried to unite certain groups. And one day he's sleeping, and but he happens to put his foot towards the altar of a Muslim church. And that hurt the guy who was taking care of the church, because nobody has a right to lie down and put their foot towards the altar. It's all right to put your head to the altar, not your foot. This is a desecration. So he comes and turns the guy's foot to put his head to face it. And as he's turning the foot of the Nanak, who is resting from a long journey, the altar starts to fall in Nanak's foot. Well, you can imagine, every time he turns his body, the altar starts moving. So Nanak wake up and says, what's the problem? He tries to explain, and then he starts respecting Nanak. But Nanak is trying to help these people to understand, and he's in the area called Punjab. Well, a lot of people in those areas would do things to create problems. And okay. So one night, the followers of Nanak were accused of raiding some camp and they couldn't find who the actual person that did it. They came to Nanak and said that one of your people has hurt our village and has done certain things to us, and we are looking for that individual to punish him. And Nanak looked at his group and says, if he is my group, I'll punish him. And he turns around and he says, pick him out. And they walk up to one of his men and he said, this man. And Nanak pulled him out and said, all right, you're certain it's him? He said, yes, that's him. He says, then I'll execute him right now for what you claim he has done. So Nanak asked for a sword and executed the man right there. But while he's executing the man, one of their own people standing in the crowd fell down with the same cut across his chest, dying at the same time. Then they realized what a lie they had pulled off. Nanak didn't say anything. They buried their man, but they hauled away the other man who was the true criminal. But Nanak then declared once and for all that his people will be distinguished all the time, mm-hmm. and they'll never be able to fool nobody. They're going to wear a turban, number one. They're going to keep their beard, number two. They're going to wear a bracelet so that it can't come off, so you're going to see it. They're going to carry a short sword to protect women and children and the sick. And they're going to wear a comb, and they will be known as Sikhs from now on. Nobody will ever accuse them of doing something other than... So today, the Sikhs have become... Most of the professional occupation is security work. He really started the first religious security activity. So each one of these people are looking for their own... Messiah. Yes, because he doesn't intend to go out of business before midnight eternity.
What's going to happen, getting down to now, what's going to happen between now and the year 2000?
In the next 14 years?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's broad, okay? There's been a lot of people predicting everything from famine to, you know, AIDS being the Black Plague.
I can only quote Yukteswar, the stars foretell that they don't compel. And the things I do you shall do also, and greater things shall you do. Then you sell yourself short if you don't use those laws. And as many as received me, to them gave me the power to become sons of God, even unto those who accept my name. Now, these pledges were made by living men. They were not made by people of a figment of imagination. These men live. I had to test it for my own self, if really these laws do work. Do we really have to be victim of the projected anguish triggered by the many beings who are hurt and seek some kind of a breakdown in the planetary system because their anguish isn't resolved? Or do we have the right to resolve it in a compensatory way? I cannot block the cosmic wars that are generated by man's anguish, but I sure could apply the laws of God to operate in a compensatory way to have no major destruction without cause. You have that right, as much I have that right, because it's given to us by men like Yukteswar, men like Jesus, Kabir, and all these other men that have lived. One, snow may have to fall.
I'm sorry?
Snow may have to fall.
Snow may have to fall.
Because they predict it. Compensatory action is, I'll settle for rain. Keep the snow. Jesus said to the wind, peace be still. But he said, don't come back. Did he say that? Mm-hmm. So the wind must blow. Compensatory action is, peace be still, till we get out of the water. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Showing you where compensatory, what we rights we have, even more as an initiate. We have these rights. As many as received me, to them gave me the power to become sons of God. I was not present, therefore I can't utilize that exchange. But those who believe on my name, I came after. And the name of a realized man is his own word. If he can't back up his word, then he's got nothing to believe in. So the mere fact that he's lived and he is extending his qualities to us who hear of his name, who are not present in his body when he's there, but he's extending this quality of the power to control the environmental conditions that they don't destroy us, then we have that right to exercise it. It's like I leaving you a credit card as an inheritance, and the credit card is good no matter what you sign on it, because I have left it with that particular qualification. And you may not see me or hear of me, but you have the credit card. That's like believing in the name. You are given the quality to apply the power to suspend calamity and hold things in check, but not to remove them totally from where they have to function as a means to confront us, but they don't have to be destructive to all of us.
Okay, several things trying to follow that train, and several things that I heard tonight. It started out by, you know, three phases, one of which was cleaning up the body, so that, and you, I think you used something like, so the disease wouldn't come in. Okay, obviously that can relate to what I'm talking about in terms of AIDS or any other disease, if we're under as initiates and so forth, following this cleansing of the body. Also, when you were talking about the 22nd, reading the 22nd Psalm, somebody obviously wrote it, meaning predicted prophecy that decided to come true for whatever reason. Somebody didn't change the stars or change the, you know, compelling situation, but that was carried out by Jesus. A lot about history, which was fascinating. I don't think I could repeat it all, but you know, fascinating, and also sort of tying in, you know, with things repeating, nonviolence, whether we want to look at Martin Luther King or Gandhi or whoever, people have taken these tools and repeated it within our own country. So I guess I'm thinking about, in terms of being, you know, as an initiate, and I'm not a master yet. Maybe those things can only be used by me as a, you know, to a limit. Can I say, no snow, but rain, please? And instantly it will be there. As opposed to, you know, if an acid rain comes or transportation blocks, food getting to Tucson, that could be a reality. So I'm sort of thinking about the quality of a life, preparing myself, not in terms of not enjoying or being here in the moment, but kind of looking at myself, my family, other people who are involved. It may take me time, talking about me personally, to get to the point of being able to fully utilize that process.
We have the option, regardless of develop or not develop,
mm-hmm.
to exercise a modification. We cannot remove the conditions.
Mm-hmm.
They're set to occur. But we can phase down the intensity with a modification of it. I cannot avoid the weather changing and becoming horrible to drive through. But I could choose the difference between it being snow or rain, just as much I can choose it being hot or cool. But I can't say that the weather must go away and never come back. That's not going to be valid. Jesus never did that, and no wise man never did that. All they did was modify the situation to make life livable. But they did not eradicate it. There is no way for us to eradicate anything. They're set up by nature for us to confront. But by virtue of this, we can set up the modification process, which you call grace. From here to here, look, see? I gotta let go. That's karma. It got to go. Can't stop it. Right? That's karma. No. I can do like that. What did I do just now?
Grace.
Good. And that is exactly what we have endowed in us by the applying of the law. We are the manifested God in an individualistic state. The God is already accepted his atomic nature, blowing it apart or not. It's going to be there either we like it or not. But we also have the power to modify. So we are only given one promise. Go forth, multiply, and have dominion over the universe. We don't have ownership, and we cannot set up franchises. But we have dominion, which is the capacity to modify. The universe is already here, atomically exploding on its own, doing its own thing. Even if we end up in the next planetary system and think it's ideal to live, we're going to find a lot of things that are not going to be practical for us until we learn to modify it. But it's going on right now. What we call pollution, what's going on is pollution. Our pollution to us is death to other creatures.
Mm-hmm.
See? So each thing is going on, but it's the modification that we have. So not to be afraid of conditions. All right, Siberia has snow. They've been living with it for a long time. Have they complained about it?
No, but they were prepared. I mean, through whatever process, whatever people I'm talking about, it went through some phase of being prepared.
They were prepared for Americans to sing, I'm dreaming of a white Christmas. Let them have all of Alaska, all of Siberia. We'll take their green pasture land. In the last 4 years, I've heard this song, I'm dreaming of a white Christmas. Everywhere I went in Texas, I said, this is nonsense. Who the hell wants a white Christmas in an area that isn't designed for a white Christmas? And to pray for it and sing it all the time would ruin the weather. And you know what happened? They had their white Christmas to the point where they got broke. And so I said to myself, Lord, I don't want to fight the snow, but I'll take rain. Give back the Alaskans and give back the Siberians their snow. Let them enjoy the snow because they had it for centuries, long before I came along. Mm-hmm. Texas has had its green pasture and its longhorns. Give us back that. From then on, rain is falling all through summertime, wintertime. So I'm not boasting about it, but I'm making compensations in my consciousness for what? Wherever I go, to see if there's a possible way to restitution of compensation and not have it destructive. This is our option. This is really our right. We have that right. It's not boasting about it. It's that when you go, and they say the weather in this area is lousy and bad. How did it get lousy and bad?
Sonics.
Or Sonics put it that way. So by the same token, Jesus says if you apply the law, it will make restitution. It's not going to eradicate bad weather coming to that area, but it can phase down the quality of badness. But you can live with it. It's comfortable to live with the rain instead of living with massive snow all the time. It's comfortable to live with the little intermittent rain when it's hot than to have it hot all the time. You know what I mean? So now in Houston, rain never fall as much. It was always hot. And they were always crying for snow. And we got so snow in one time, it looked kind of ridiculous. Now we're having intermittent rain. But I'll take the intermittent rain. And the same thing when the hurricane was coming through. The Irene hurricane passed over my building where I live, in Houston. And so everybody said, Dana, you're in the midst of the hurricane. I said, yeah. Wait till you hear about him again.
Him
again. Yeah, him again. And then he really run. Because I'm him again, you know. Him again is different than hurricane. No, you see, I don't believe that we have to be a victim of the weather. Since we are designed by the Creator to have dominion over the universe, weather, all these different things must adhere to the spoken word. We have to rebuild our trust in the spoken word. We have ruined it by not understanding it and by applying it incorrectly. Until we rebuild the trust in it, it will never work for us. It will always be destructive to us. But once we rebuild it and clean up ourselves, I'm not going to refuse rain, sunshine, hot weather and everything in the areas. No, they are there to function. But I have a right to experience it in a modified state. And I'll take a modified state, a comfortable state, not a destructive state, but I'm not going to reject its existence and say, don't come back. That's not valid because it has to come around. The earth has to turn and it has to have different reactions of the temperature. But in the turning, it can be modified. And this is your option as a being. You're not going to erase it or drive it away permanently, but you can modify it. And you have that right. You're given that right by all the realized persons that have passed through the planet. So you. Thank you.
You're coming back in June?
In June, I'll be coming through.
Was he working on it? Or?
Still more left.
There's still more left? We meditate here Sunday evenings at 8 o'clock. We're almost. No.
Thank you. I'll give you a song. It's for tomorrow when the sunrise comes up. The Lord is walking in my heart today. The Lord is walking in my heart today. Way down in Calvary land, way down in Calvary land, they nailed him to a cross. They nailed him to a cross. They thought that they had won. They thought that they had won. But the Lord is walking in my heart today. But the Lord is walking in my heart today. That's tomorrow. See? Always remind yourself of that one thing, that death is no trip to those who want to live to live, because the model has come to teach us that. But where is the model supposed to store itself? It's in your heart. Always in your heart. Go there whenever you're in doubt of yourself. And think of the cross, and the fact he's nailed to a cross, and the people who did the nailing thought they won, they got rid of him, and then to their surprise, he's no longer there. But where is he now? In your heart. He's walking always in your heart, in the now time. You have that right and that option. So I can't say man is not going to fight himself with a lot of atomic weaponry. It's impossible. He's going to always want to fight. But my option is to face down the conditions as much to survive. Now you have to, another option is, it's a whole lot better to lose equipment that costs money than to lose lives. So whenever you hear of calamities or conditions that are facing each other, always have not the thought that the minimal life is lost to the maximal amount of property, so they go to work, than to wish them to fight. The good example is when the shuttle blew up at the same time the U.S. Navy was moving on Gaddafi. It would have been one of the two things. If the battle began in the Gaddafi area, they lost 100 lives versus the 7 lives versus the amount of property that's being broken up and the amount of work that can really come back. So when you look at situations, they may look horrible, but always look in terms of the life and the property. These are ways nature has to work out karma. Better to save the quantity of life and let the property break down and start them to work. Same with Mexico. I was in Santa Barbara at the time, and we heard the building shake, and somebody said it's an earthquake. And so I did, I go on, get out of here, okay. We don't need them. Next morning we hear it's in Mexico. And the funny part is the amount of buildings that fall down versus the amount of lives. It could have been worse if it really took it and broke down in the area where we were. Because it cut across right through the St. Andrews Fault. And then a lot more lives would have lost to the amount of property. So it went to an area where more property was lost with minimal life. Then the second earthquake came not too long after that, a couple of days after. Again, it was more property breaking down with less life. This is the option. Yogananda did this, and if Yogananda didn't do it, I wouldn't say it's possible in today's time. One day he was sitting in his office writing, and the building was shaking. And one of the sisters, he used to call Ganisak. In those days, Nunu was the theme. And she was a very wealthy woman. Her father owned the Calavo avocado orchards. So she was staying there, and she came in and said, Master, there's an earthquake predicted. coming in, what can he do? And she was praying with all her might for it to stop. And then she heard him call her, Ganesak. She told me the story later. Yes, Master, come here. You go take your shoes, hit that wall, and tell that earthquake to go home and don't come back and bother us. Go someplace and hide himself. So she took her shoes off, walked over the wall, and hit the wall, and said, now get out of here, don't come back here, or go hide yourself someplace else. This occurred about 3 o'clock, that afternoon about 4 or 5 o'clock. The news on the radio has this. Strange earthquake comes to California. Disappears in 10 minutes, leaving minimal damage and minimal loss of life. I went to see the area where the big crack in the wall is, you see, in the building. And I asked them, how is that? And then this person pointed out, that's the woman who was in there. She told me what was happening, what Yogananda had done. And she said that was his attitude of facing down calamity. He never rejected the condition of nature, but he always said, your option to face it down is your right as a human being. You have that right. And if you don't exercise it, then you're not accepting the God in you. The dominion, not ownership, because we don't have ownership, we have dominion. We don't have to be victimized by the laws of nature that are tempting to destroy us. But we do have the right to face them.
Sai Baba did that before the Mexico earthquake. He told some devotees before the earthquake, he said, don't worry, the earthquake, he said, all devotees will be protected, not one.
Right. This is part of the process too, you see. The devotee or the initiate is under the protective consciousness of the realized masters. But that doesn't say the non-initiate is not. The non-initiate also has some compensatory action in their favor. If they associate with initiates or they reach out for their own internal growth, then extension of grace goes to them, because life is more important than property or material object, the saving of the life of the world. So no realized master meditating would allow a large quantity of lives to be destroyed. Even though in the autobiography of a yogi, they say, Lahiri Mayasha was meditating, and he said, I'm drowning off the coast of Japan or someplace. And some people said, oh my gosh. Well, there is a story though that goes like this. They said that somebody on board the boat was drowning and prayed so deeply to God to save his life because he didn't know how to swim. A door flew off the boat from the wooden side of the deck and blew right in front of him. Plop! A door big enough to float and big enough for him to hold on to wait until he got rescued by the ship that was coming in to pick up as many rescuers. But he never knew who threw the how the boat. But what happened? He went back home to Japan, and he went to school, did his, and got married and everything.